We're driven by the search for better. But when it comes to hiring, the best way to search for a candidate isn't to search at all. Don't search, match with Indeed. Indeed is your matching and hiring platform with over 350 million global monthly visitors, according to Indeed data, and a matching engine that helps you find quality candidates fast. Ditch the busy work. Use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. Leveraging over 140 million qualifications and preferences every day, Indeed's matching engine is constantly learning from your preferences. So the more you use Indeed, the better it gets. Join more than 3.5 million businesses worldwide that use Indeed to hire great talent fast. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/Blue Wire. Just go to Indeed.com/Blue Wire right now and support our show by saying that you heard about Indeed on this podcast. That's Indeed.com/Blue Wire. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed.
Blue Wire.
What is up, Nets fans? Welcome to Brooklyn Buzz. I'm Nick Vey. With me, as always, Jack Manuel. Jack, how are we doing?
Happy birthday, Kevin Durant.
Yeah, happy birthday, KD. You know, join up with Team USA. They'll give you a random birthday shout-out. But, Jack, we're going to talk about some free agent forwards today. We talked about guard centers, which you can find on all streaming platforms. But, Jack, before we talk about the forwards that the Nets are going to target, what do you think they should be looking at this position? You know, obviously it's a small forward, power forward, versatility, whatever, but just kind of at that forward slash wing spot, what are you looking for?
Everything that Jeff Green did for us this year, Nick. You know, yeah. I think that we saw the prototype of what can work next to Kevin Durant, what can work next to Kyrie Irving, what can work next to James Harden. Jeff Green, good defender, really good three-point shooting this season. I think it was a bit of an outlier, but yep. You know, a good three-point shooting nonetheless. Can create a shot a little bit here and there, you know, off the dribble. He's still got the pops athletically, still really strong. You know, you want a guy to sort of interchange with KD on defensive possessions, guarding some of those superstar wings and maybe even fives, which Jeff Green did on regular occasions. So if you're looking at the skill set of a player that you want to sort of fit into that rotation, look no further than Jeff Green.
Yeah, no, definitely. Like you said, the versatility is what really strikes, you know, the ability to do multiple things and also complement the best players in the team. Now, Jack, if you were looking more for like the small forward or like the 2-3, is there anything different that you'd be looking at skill set wise or still mostly versatility?
I think if you're looking for it, Nick, it's probably you would lean more towards just defense or 3-point shooting.
Yep,
you're
getting, 3 and D.
Yeah, 3 and D, provide a bit of space for Kai and James and Kevin in that sort of respect. And, you know, a guy that doesn't need the ball in his hand a heap. And I think that a lot of the names that probably at that small forward position, that, you know, we looked at the Hoops Hype sort of list of free agents, a lot of those guys, you know, unless you're Kawhi Leonard, you know, generally do have the ability to do that. You know, a lot of them are older. They sort of know, you know, how to be successful in this league, having been there and done that. So I think that I'd prefer someone who's got a little bit of defensive versatility, but at the same time, we've sort of seen the Nets this season, you know, be able to turn it on a little bit defensively when they need to. Someone that just has a somewhat above average, you know, skill, whether that's shooting, yep. whether that's, I don't know, maybe playmaking. You know, I don't necessarily, I think shooting or defense would be ideal.
Yeah, I agree. I also think it's important for this position too, for the Nets to add depth. You know, like you mentioned, they had Jeff Green, but there really wasn't many options after that. Obviously, you have the superstar in Kevin Durant, but then really the next closest forward you had was, you know, like TLC and Alize Johnson. You know, you're looking to get someone with a little bit more experience, especially when you go against some of those bigger teams in the postseason.
TLC's ready to pop off in Tokyo, ladies and gents.
Yeah, we'll see what happens there. But Jack, obviously we know the Nets are extremely limited in what they can do in the offseason in terms of money spending. They have the taxpayer mid-level exception, essentially veteran minimums in which they can throw out. Obviously, they can make trades too. Do you think the forward position is where they should spend that taxpayer mid-level exception on Jeff Green or either on another forward?
Oh, absolutely. You know, I think that if you can get Jeff Green for the taxpayer mid-level exception, given what he did this season, I don't necessarily expect him to drop off a cliff next season. I think that you're absolutely winning, and it's an absolute home run if you're Sean Marks and Joseph Tsai. So I think that that has to be priority number one. You know, if you lose Jeff Green, if you lose Spencer Dinwiddie, then there's going to be a little bit of a weakness. I mean, we didn't have Spencer Dinwiddie this season, and we were able to sort of make do with, you know, Mike James, Tyler Johnson, Chris Chioza. Whereas without Jeff Green, we sort of saw in the postseason how much his absence was felt. Yeah, Bruce is able to play a little bit up and you know, be bigger than himself, but it just leaves you with a weakness and shallowness in that rotation. So I think that wing is probably more important because we sort of saw it for a regular length through the regular season as well as through most of the postseason until, you know, Jeff's foot started playing up a little bit, whereas the Nets dealt without Spencer Dinwiddie. And I think that you can almost deal without Spencer Dinwiddie because the Nets already have two superstar guards and they sort of cancel each other out in their own depth. But both of them, you know, Kobe, we know, is injury prone, doesn't necessarily play 82 games this season. And now James Harden's hamstrings, and now he's in his early 30s as well. So you want to have someone at least decent enough and replaceable there in the rotation. But I think you want to have a greater strength in terms of your depth in a wing, especially if Jeff Green is lost.
Yeah, I agree, Jack. I think, like you said, I think you just simply look at it from Kyrie Irving and James Harden collecting most of those minutes at the guard position. Like, regardless if you go in the postseason, both those guys are probably playing 40 minutes. And then obviously you have Kevin Durant for one of the forward spots. But then also you want to have the option to have the versatility of, you know, playing him at maybe small ball five, playing him at the three, playing him at the four. So that's why you have the depth, then you have the options. So I also think, like, another important part to this position that we didn't mention before would be if they can add another closing option. Even if they do bring Jeff Green back, just somebody who's comfortable and a veteran that you could put out there in a playoff game, maybe not even close it, but just be like, all right, they can play 20 minutes in this game and I'm not going to feel terrible. Like you said, you know, Jeff Green being hurt was crucial. Like, obviously Kyrie and James Harden being hurt was even bigger, but even just missing Jeff Green, a fully healthy Jeff Green, they might win game seven.
Yeah, because, like, it was him and KD, you know, throughout, you know, postseason games. And, you know, Jeff Green's 29 points, I think it was, in one of the matches.
He hit a million threes.
Yeah, and he was just absolutely flamethrower. So I think that if you lose Jeff Green, you know, you lose, you know, a pretty significant piece in your playoff rotation. If you keep him, then you have at least a little bit of a luxury, and maybe, you know, you get a guy like an Otto Porter Jr. or whatever, and, you know, he's a little bit better than Joe Harris in the postseason or whatever, then you got that flexibility, which the Nets didn't really have, and not a lot of superstar teams do have, because when you're superstar heavy, you know, you're filling out the rest of the roster generally with, like, vet minimums and whatever mid-level exception that you've got left. So I will also say, I guess, going back to the guard slash wing conversation, I think you just want talent as well, Nick. You know, you just want the best player available. So, like, if you can get, I don't know, Patty Mills versus, I don't know, Trevor Ariza, then give me Patty Mills. Whereas maybe Trevor Ariza is a better fit and you could put him out there and, you know, he could be PJ Tucker light. Patty Mills can win you a playoff game. You know, he can go hot from three and maybe might not be able to play in the postseason or whatever. And maybe that's not the best comparison. And maybe it's because I just saw him lead out my country last night in the opening ceremony and got a bit of a tear in my eye. And, you know, the Patty Mills train is continuing to run hot on the Brooklyn Buzz. But I think you still just, you prioritize talent. And I think that that is what Kevin Durant does. I think that's what Sean Marks has always done anyway. Best player available wherever it is, free agency, draft, etc.
Yeah, I think that's the most important thing. But I also think, like, at some point, too, you just got to worry about depth. Like, I think with the taxpayer mid-level exception, like you're saying, you go for the talent, but then you need to focus your veteran minimums. Obviously, you have unlimited amounts of those, but you need to focus on, like, okay, we still need to make sure we have some size because, you know, Milwaukee is a team that we're going to see again. You know, Philadelphia is a relatively big team. So there are some other options. Like you said, I think it leads to that word that you mentioned, flexibility. And that's what the Nets kind of lacked. Some of that was due to injuries, but some of that was just due to, you know, we made a trade for James Harden midseason and we weren't able to necessarily add all the pieces we wanted.
Yeah, I mean, we don't want a 2020 bubble situation where it's about 18 shooting guards on the roster.
Yep.
No wings at all. It's just like, you know, Jamal Crawford, Caris LeVert, Trish Chioza, and then, yeah, Jared Allen's there as well. He's going to be our power forward slash center.
Yeah, no worries, Jared. Do everything. But, Jack, I guess getting to some of the players the Nets could target, who are you looking at? Obviously, this could be taxpayer mid-level exception or this could be veteran minimum. So there's a little bit more flexibility than some of the other discussions we've had about players.
Yeah, I mean, and this is probably the list where I have the most names. Outside of Jeff Green, who has had a pretty intense discussion about and is, for me, still priority number one. despite all of these names here, obviously, if you can get maybe one or two of them, it replaces the need for just having Jeff.
But Jeff to take the minimum, which is not out of the realm of possibility.
No, it's not. No, it's not. It depends on, I guess, what the outside market is willing to give him too. But a name that I'll throw in there, Nick, is Nicholas Batum. You know, obviously, he showed what he could do in this postseason for the Los Angeles Clippers, and if anything, was underutilized at times by Ty Lue. And I think some of that might have been actually for health purposes. I don't think he had the runs or reps in the legs to be able to go, you know, Jeff Green and play 35 minutes a night. But when he was out there, you're playing small ball five a lot of the time. You know, when Ivica Zubac was off the floor or Marcus Morris was on the floor, they were sort of interchangeable in that front court. He was super. And, you know, he had games where his defense, his three-point shooting, his reliability. Look, we don't necessarily have the biggest love of Frenchmen currently on the Brooklyn Nets, but if we replace one Frenchman with a more experienced and reliable one, I'm taking Batum every day. And I think Nets Twitter was in love with him and salivating after him and sort of like, you know, what we could have had in throughout the regular season. And it was just like, I think like the OTG at OTG Basketball Twitter page did a random tweet of just like Nicholas Batum hitting a massive clutch three in the regular season. And Nets fans were just getting all salty in the replies. And I'm like, yeah, I kind of feel that way as well. It's just like, you want what you could have had. And we could have had Batum. But ultimately, Jeff Green, I think, was still a bit of a more serviceable player as well.
Yeah, honestly, though, they both could have worked, especially given the injuries and after the trade. I think, you know, in hindsight, if Batum knew that the Nets were going to trade for James Harden and that would open up playing time for him, I think he would have maybe considered Brooklyn a little bit more, because I think that was one of the bigger reasons why he went to L.A. is they were going to give him that time, and he really performed well. Like, even, you know, I thought he would, you know, kind of bounce back with a winning team, but he really bounced back to another level. And like you said, you know, if you did lose Jeff Green, this would be a guy you'd want to replace him with. He's not as big, but he still provides a lot of that versatility. And he just has a lot of different skills, like you said. You know, solid rebounder, solid defender, can knock down a three, can play make a little bit, can knock down a little bit of scoring for you. So just kind of that complementary role player that you kind of love to have on championship teams.
Yeah, Giannis is only a little bit better than him, even though the player comps, we heard those little, Jason Kidd, man, get that good. Yeah. Thank God we're not talking about Jason Kidd as our head coach, and good luck, Dallas.
Yeah, I mean, that was close to that happening again. But moving on to another name, you kind of hinted at him earlier, Otto Porter. You know, obviously he's had his connections to the Nets, could be a guy that they add in terms adding that three-point shooting, add some good defense, but the real problem with him is he cannot stay on the court.
Yeah, I wonder if, like Tyler Johnson's mum, Otto Porter Jr.'s mum is a big fan of Sean Marks. Would not be surprised whatsoever. Yeah, but
maybe the whole family.
Look, he got a very nice contract from the Washington Wizards, and I know my boy Nick Busick isn't necessarily happy about that in hindsight. Yeah, the health thing is the number one thing at the end of the day, Nick, and that could benefit the Nets in a realm where it's just like, you know, they get him on a vet minimum, but also, you know, you don't want to have your roster taken up by guys who can't play minutes. We saw that with DeAndre Jordan this season, you know, from game 60 onwards throughout the postseason, where it was just like, we're the guy making $10 million who is doing nothing for us. Yeah. Now, is Otto Porter Jr. going to be that? How serviceable, reliable can he be? I think that ultimately on a vet minimum, you're taking flyers anyway. You're not necessarily going to get Jeff Green. We were incredibly, incredibly lucky as Nets fans, and Sean Marks was incredibly fortuitous to get the amount of productivity out of a vet minimum that Jeff Green did give us, and even Blake Griffin in that regard as well.
Yep.
Both of those guys, quality rotation dudes. You know, Blake Griffin, maybe the best Giannis defender since, I don't know, Al Horford. but in saying that, I think that the prototype of player we're talking about is Otto Porter Jr. And, you know, his age isn't, he's not over the hill. He's not one of these guys like 35, 36, 37.
28.
Like he's in his late 20s. So it's going to be about, you know, what the medicals are. And maybe in a Brooklyn Nets situation, you know, how he is used, the way the Nets cater, you know, and sort of tailor, you know, the player's needs to what, you know, they can give us. It's not necessarily a one-size-fits-all thing. It's like, okay, KD, we know we need to rest you occasionally here and there. Kai, you know, you can do your thing. James wants to play whenever the hell he wants. Joe's going to be reliable as hell. Clax will ramp up your minutes a little bit, you know, from 15 to 25 and get you sort of your legs under you. I think that the way that the Nets medical and training staff do that, that could leave you with a mindset of positivity towards if Otto Porter Jr. was to come to Brooklyn. But at the same time, you can't necessarily change a guy's body.
Yeah, 100%. And obviously last year between the Bulls and the Magic, he played 28 games. You know, the year before that between Washington and Chicago, it was 56 games. So it's just like there is definitely some concern. And oh, so there's another year in between where he only played 14 games. So, you know, he hasn't even logged 100 NBA games in the last three seasons. Somewhat concerning. But like you said, if you get him for a veteran minimum, this is a type of guy you want to take a flyer on, because all of a sudden, he works with Nets medical staff, stays healthy, averages 10 points a game, and gives you just another option to have. Because when healthy, he's a solid player. And the last season he had in Chicago where he was actually healthy, with the season where he was like half traded, he was starting to run pick and roll a little bit, do a little playmaking, a little bit of scoring. And after the injury, we just really didn't see that. Obviously, it's hard to be consistent when you're hurt. So that's the major question mark for this guy.
Yeah, 28 years old is literally your prime. That's when NBA players, you know, are winning championships, and you know, was when LeBron's winning his championships, KD's winning his championships. All these guys, you know, late 20s, mid to late 20s is when you sort of are in your physical and athletic prime. And maybe we look at Otto Porter Jr. as like not a 28-year-old, but like a 28-year-old in a 32-year-old body. Yep. I don't know, you know, how the mindset needs to change for him. But if we're talking about vet minimum sort of upsides, there is a huge upside to what Otto Porter Jr. can do, because, you know, if he's, we saw Kevin Durant come back from a goddamn Achilles injury, and obviously Kevin Durant is a different kettle of fish, and I'm not putting them in the same sentence. But at the same time, you know, if you're short of going, okay, with this Otto Porter Jr. over here, there's Michael Kidd-Gilchrist over here, you know, who am I going to take? Well, Michael Kidd-Gilchrist might have a better health and injury history, but Otto Porter Jr. gives you a level of, okay, this guy might be able to actually play playoff minutes for us. So it's obviously, I think that if you do end up getting Otto Porter Jr. and you are lucky enough to get him on a vet minimum, I think you want to get another wing as well at the same time. Like if the Nets retain Jeff Green, get Otto Porter Jr. as well. I think that's an ideal. But if you lose Jeff Green and Otto Porter Jr. is your facsimile replacement, you need something else, because it's just like, you just listed off the amount of games there, Nick. It feels like I've played more NBA games than Otto Porter Jr. has in the past 24 months.
Yeah, he's one of those guys where you literally are like, wow, I haven't seen him play in a while. Like, you know what I mean? Like, you watch, you don't, obviously I don't watch every single NBA game, but I watch a good amount. And it's just like certain players, you just kind of almost forget about them because they're hardly on the court. Like you said, I think it'd be important to kind of safeguard yourself because of those injuries. But obviously he could kind of pop off. Jack, who's another name you're looking at?
I pulled Millsap, Nick. Now, another guy who was rumored. We'll probably bring
I
up
thought
a lot
about
of guys.
Putting him on our center list, to be honest.
Yeah, look, power forward center. He was listed as power forward on the Hoops Hype, so blame Hoops Hype for whatever
reason. No, I'm just saying, like, transitioning forward, I think small ball five is maybe better for him because he's so, you know, he's lost a step. But I agree, he could play some four still.
Yeah, I mean, if you're playing him and KD together, you know, I think that those guys are interchangeable. Even him and Jeff Green together in backup units, I think, would be pretty good and serviceable at the same time. But it's going to be about, look, we're not going to get Paul Millsap from the 2020 bubble. I think he is like one of the guys that, unlike Jeff Green, is starting to wane in his productivity, in his reliability, but in a niche sort of role could actually give you something. And I think that there's a reliability in terms of, you know, if you throw him out for 10 minutes in a playoff game, I'd be like, I don't think Paul Millsap is going to make a heap of mistakes. I think he's going to be serviceable enough. He'll rebound the ball. He'll be strong. I think, you know, I'm not saying that, like, you know, he's going to stop Giannis or whatever, but I think he'd be okay on Giannis. I think he's got the skill set, the strength, the low center of gravity in a similar sort of way to what Blake Griffin is. It's almost like a Giannis matchup on Paul Millsap would be okay. I think Paul Millsap guarding a Joel Embiid almost gives you a little bit of flexibility there too. So I think in terms of, like, maybe he plays a role of what sort of PJ Tucker did for the Milwaukee Bucks. Doesn't really give you anything offensively, but I think Paul Millsap actually has a little bit more in his offensive bag than I think that PJ Tucker has. Whereas PJ Tucker, I think, is just better at guarding those, you know, prototypical wings. So I'm not out on the Paul Millsap experience at this point in time.
Yeah, I think he'd be a good veteran to have. I think, like you kind of hinted at, he's starting to look a little bit washed. Obviously, he's about to be 36 this season. But as a guy to have as a reserve, I'm not sure I'd want him in my playoff rotation, but he'd be a guy that at least you have the flexibility to have. Like you said, I think he'd be great for Giannis. The real thing that's hard with Paul Millsap is, like, I just think about him playing, you know, the four or the five, is like he can't really switch anymore, but his drop coverage obviously isn't great because he's not that long a player. So it's just like, he's kind of matchup specific to an extent, but that's fine if you're getting him at the veteran minimum and he understands that role, which I wouldn't rule out because I don't think he's won a championship. Yeah, he has not. He's come close, you know, with a couple teams, but hasn't got to the pinnacle. So,
yeah, I think he could be what the Warriors had with David West. You know, Paul Millsap could be to what with the Brooklyn Nets. This is just the immediate comparison that comes to mind. I'm not sure how apt and accurate it is, but I sort of just get that sort of thing where it's just like David West, you know, can get you a bucket from the mid-range here and there. Big, strong, burly dude, really good locker room presence. You know, coaches love him, the players love him. I could see Paul Millsap giving that to the Brooklyn Nets.
Yeah, and I mean, he can knock down the three ball. It's not like he shoots a ton of them, but he's a career 34% from three. You know, a year ago, 2 years ago, he shot 43% from three. So it's like...
He's good in the post as well. You know,
yeah, he's got a little touch.
Yeah, he's not necessarily like LaMarcus Aldridge, but maybe like a B-plus level of LaMarcus Aldridge. So like you sort of look at what the Nets had with LaMarcus Aldridge, maybe you get a similarity again with sort of Paul Millsap. I think LaMarcus Aldridge's size probably gives him a little bit more of a tick than Paul Millsap, who's probably small ball five, whereas LaMarcus Aldridge is a legitimate five, as much as probably he doesn't want to necessarily hear that, given, you know, he was one of the best sort of fours in San Antonio and Portland. But yeah, I think that... But Paul Millsap isn't the names that we have on this list. You know, I think at the end, Nick, I'll want to ask you a question. You know, which of these guys has the best chance to be reliable in a playoff matchup? But I think we go through the names first. But is there anyone else that sort of sticks out at that could have a shot at that maybe?
I mean, I think, you know, you look at, you mentioned Trevor Ariza. I'm not sure he's a guy you'd want in your playoff rotation, but he'd be another guy that has flexibility, has experience, someone you could throw out there and be like, okay, like you said with Millsap, you know, 10 minutes. I feel okay with him playing 10 minutes. I don't want to be the Miami Heat and depend on him like they had to this postseason. But if I have him as an option, like I think Trevor Ariza would be a possibility.
Yeah, I mean, he was okay in Miami. You know, he had some moments here or there. It's, you know, what's his story ball like? I think that hasn't necessarily deserted him, but I think that in a Mike D'Antoni situation, you know, Trevor Ariza's playing under Mike D'Antoni, you know, you see players have a bit more confidence, they let it fly. You know, I don't think that they're afraid of missing it. You know, when you've got Mike D'Antoni and Steve Nash, I think that their offense, you know, liberates players in a certain sense. So I think defensively we don't have a lot to worry about with Trevor Ariza. I think, you know, he's quite reliable and serviceable there. Championship level experience as well, you know, been around the wings. You know, if you give me Trevor Ariza, I probably, you know, there's a world where, you know, he is more reliable, more productive than a Paul Millsap, to be honest. And, you know, he's a better as like a sort of wing dude. And in a finals matchup, you know, maybe Paul Millsap's better on Giannis in the Eastern Conference Finals, but in the Western, in the National NBA Finals against a LeBron James, I think Trevor Ariza is probably better. So, you know, they've both got their pluses, they've both got their negatives.
Yeah, 100%. I mean, another name I guess I was looking at, obviously you kind of hinted at him, I think it's probably unlikely at this point, would be PJ Tucker. You know, he has the relationship with Kevin Durant, but given the Bucks just won a championship, I feel like he'll re-sign.
Yeah, Wanda loves him as well. So yeah, I think that's always a good sign. And look, I think that the Milwaukee beer is tasting pretty goddamn good right now for PJ Tucker. And he's getting a little boozy out there in Wisconsin. So I think that it's normally when a championship does happen, you know, they always do run it back unless you're Jerry Krause or whatever. So I think that it's more than likely that we see PJ Tucker in Milwaukee again. But it was interesting because I think that initially before in last year's preseason, in last free agency, you know, his priority, I think, was to get a semblance of a payday. Yeah. Whereas at this point in time, I don't think that is priority number one. And maybe it still is.
I think it'll be easier with the Bucks because they'll have his bird right. So they can give him a better deal than what probably the market would.
Yeah. And look, I don't ultimately, you know, I think that he's a louder defender than he is a productive defender.
Yeah.
You know, I think I made this comparison on one of our post games. You know, he's Pat Beverly at the forward position sometimes. I think that he is a bit smarter than Pat Beverly is. And he certainly did make life tough for Kevin Durant in certain matchups. But Kevin Durant also had, like, you know, 50-40-90 in the postseason and you know, had some of the best performances that we've ever seen in a Brooklyn Nets uniform or in any uniform for that matter. So, look, if we see PJ Tucker again in next year's postseason, next year's regular season, we're going to have some fun things to talk about.
Yeah, I think, and like you kind of hinted at, Jack, I think there'd probably be a slight decline for him. Like, obviously, he's not the same defender he was in Houston when him and Harden were making those runs. And I think he'd be good for the Nets for, like, Giannis. And the reason he works on KD to an extent is because KD's game isn't super athletic-based. It's a lot of skill-based, a lot of post stuff like that. So I think it allowed Tucker to have more of an impact than maybe he would against, you know, some different superstars in this league. But, Jack, any other names you're looking at?
With PJ Tucker as well, Nick, I do also think that if the Nets had Harden and or Irving healthy, it makes him less effective.
Yep.
Because if the Bucks are going to continue to switch and he gets switched onto a guard, you know, Devin Booker cooked him pretty relentlessly. Yep. You know, Chris Paul was able to get under him. He doesn't have the lateral quickness, as you sort of alluded to as well. So if you have one of your superstar guys healthy, get the switch onto PJ Tucker, cook him, and just drive to the rim against him. I don't think he has that. You know, I mean, he's got enough, you know, great quality NBA basketball shoes, but I don't think that they can necessarily help his lateral quickness. But yeah.
I agree, and I think that's where you look at it, too, in the Nets scheme. It's like, okay, now is he chasing a defender, trying to go over screens, and everyone else is switching? Kind of complicates things. Obviously, you worry about that in training camp and other things, and that's Steve Nash's problem.
If you love listening to the Brooklyn Buzz, what's stopping you from grabbing a mic and starting your own show? And there's no better place than Blue Wire Hustle. Hustle was created to give everyone the opportunity to take your podcast to the next level. Or if you want to host a podcast and you just don't know where to start, Hustle is the perfect place for you. As part of the program, you'll receive personal cover art, Q&As with Blue Wire's top podcasters, access to our community Discord, e-learning courses full of tips and tricks, and on top of that, we'll help you get your show on Apple, Spotify, Google, Stitcher, and all other listening platforms. And the best part is, you get it all for $15 a month, the same rate as any other hosting site would charge just for the initial setup. So if you're ready to do more than just listen, talk to us about your favorite team, then make your voice heard in Hustle. Acceptance in the program is limited, so get your application in today. To apply, go to bwhustle.com/join. Check out the description box in the episode to find out more, but that's bwhustle.com/join.
We're driven by the search for better. But when it comes to hiring, the best way to search for a candidate isn't to search at all. Don't search, match with Indeed. Indeed is your matching and hiring platform with over 350 million global monthly visitors, according to Indeed data, and a matching engine that helps you find quality candidates fast. Ditch the busy work. Use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. Leveraging over 140 million qualifications and preferences every day, Indeed's matching engine is constantly learning from your preferences. So the more you use Indeed, the better it gets. Join more than 3.5 million businesses worldwide that use Indeed to hire great talent fast. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/BlueWire. Just go to Indeed.com/BlueWire right now and support our show by saying that you heard about Indeed on this podcast. That's Indeed.com/BlueWire. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed.
Philip has just lost the respect of the Youth League football team he coaches. He was asked what New England should do in the draft, and his answer was objectively terrible. The Athletic just wrote a great article about this, but Philip doesn't have The Athletic or the respect of a boisterous group of 11-year-olds who once looked up to him. Learn from Philip's error, get The Athletic, and get the info you need to speak draft fluently.
Whether you're a world-class athlete or a podcaster like me, we all understand the importance of mental and physical well-being and proper recovery for top-notch performance. That's why I'm excited that Unified Healing is sponsoring this podcast. Unified Healing is a new and super innovative global network of wellness centers powered by Energy Enhancement System, or EE System. If you haven't heard of the EE System, you'll want to listen up. This technology promotes wellness, deep relaxation, purification, and rejuvenation. In hundreds of locations across the globe, access to a center is easy and affordable. Interested in experiencing the EE System technology for yourself? Go to unifiedhealing.com/bluewire to learn more and find a center near you. That's unifiedhealing.com/bluewire. No material or testimonials on the Unified Healing website are intended to be viewed as medical advice or a substitute for professional medical advice, diagnosis, or treatment. Always seek the advice of your physician or other qualified healthcare provider with any questions you may have regarding a medical condition or treatment and before undertaking a new healthcare regimen, including EE System.
But another guy would be Torrey Craig from the Suns. But I feels like he's another guy that's probably going to be back with the Suns, just given the situation and it worked out. And I don't think his market's going to be crazy. So why would he leave?
Yeah, I mean, he's got a ring now, doesn't he? Because like, he was technically
he did. Yeah, I think he was the guy that was the win-win situation. He got a ring regardless.
Yeah, it's the sort of Anderson Varejao experience for Torrey Craig. So look, I similarly to Nicholas Batum, I was quite high on Torrey Craig. You know, around that sort of the sort of buyout market and such. I thought that he would be the prime A candidate in my eyes. You know, him and Dwayne Dedman, I was probably all in on. And ultimately, what he showed for the Phoenix Suns was that he's still got something there. Yep. And he's the sort of guy that's like the beyond box score dude. Yep. You know, he could put up nothing. He could put up a Tony Snell line, but still having a massive impact on the game. And that's where I think that Torrey Craig is almost a pretty great fit in Brooklyn. And why I was so high on him, I think he plays above his position. He can also play below. I think his defensive versatility might be the best out of the forwards that are available on the market right now. You know, obviously he's still in his 20s and yep. he's still got his prime athleticism, and his good days aren't far from behind him. So I'm really, really high on Torrey Craig, but yeah, the likelihood, I guess, Nicky, who do you think's more likely out of Torrey Craig and PJ Tucker to be a Brooklyn Net? Obviously PJ Tucker has the Kevin Durant connection, and Torrey Craig doesn't really have any connection to Brooklyn, I guess.
I mean, they just lost, so I'll just go with the Suns. You know what I mean? I think it's hard to leave a winning situation, especially if you're going to, quote unquote, run it back and have an opportunity to maybe win another championship. And where I think if you're Torrey Craig and you're looking at the Suns, are you like, are you sure they're going to get back there? Does Kevin Durant call me and kind of recruit me? Is that something that could happen? And just another thing on Torrey Craig is he kind of has like a little bit of Bruce Brown to his game. You know, there's some similarities in terms of just like those hustle, gritty plays, you know, playing bigger than their size and just kind of being annoying, but in like a good way, not like a Patrick Beverley way, but just like a toughness way where it's just like, okay, yeah, you thought you had a free rebound? Nope.
Yeah, I think that Craig, we can imagine the Torrey Craig experience would be a lot of fun if he were to come to Brooklyn, which is why... Yeah. I was so high on him in the first place.
Another guy I think's a possibility that would come at like a cheap deal. I wouldn't want them to spend money on him, but I could see him chasing a ring, and that'd be Rudy Gay.
Yeah, Rudy Gay was probably, out of the guys that were sort of spoken about, Nick, I think that he almost provides you a level of service and productivity that I think is probably as good as any of these other guys, especially offensively.
Yep.
That mid-range shot is... I don't think it's ever going to fade away from him. It's the shot that, last. I'm sure Michael Jordan can still hit, the mid-range elbow jumper, and Chris Paul's going to be hitting it, until he's, in the goddamn grave. But I think that, and Rudy Gay showed in San Antonio when, Pop was sort of showing a little bit more flexibility and a bit more experimentation. He played five. He played above his position. He was, legitimately a three. He was only a three, and then as his career continued to span, and he was good enough at it. He is a good rebounder, a decent enough 3-point shooter. I think that out of all these guys, Nick, there's the flaws in his game. While there might be pronounced for a PJ Tucker in terms of his lack of offense, there obviously is flaws in Rudy Gay's in game and all of these guys' game for that matter. But I think that the flaws are the least pronounced maybe out of a lot of these wings that are available.
Yeah, I think the biggest flaw with Rudy Gay is probably the defense. And I think you look at it in a championship situation, you say to yourself, okay, is he going to put in that extra level of effort, considering his role is going to change? And then I think offensively, there's been at times, question marks with the efficiency and the shot selection. But again, in the situation with the Nets, could he be the best version of himself in terms of just being that complimentary role player? Obviously, this guy was a fringe all-star at one point, but I think with the Nets, he could kind of just find that right rhythm for himself, and that could be, big. And I think it's realistic just because he hasn't won a championship and he's had such a long career. This is a guy who's been playing since he's 20 years old.
Yeah, I mean, we could get essentially what Jeff Green, all the question marks you just listed about, Rudy Gay were listed on Jeff Green and, his yep. entire career, in every other team that he's played for.
Yeah.
So you could essentially get, a facsimile of Jeff Green with Rudy Gay. And if Jeff Green were to leave or depart in some form or fashion, Rudy Gay would probably be pretty high on the list as a replacement, just given, what he does, his skill set, yep. the size, the interchangeability, the ability to be in the playoff rotation, and just a lot of the things that Jeff Green does, Rudy Gay can do, and maybe we see a better version of it in Brooklyn as well.
Jack, if you had the option to have Nick Batum and Rudy Gay or Jeff Green and Trevor Ariza, what would you roll with?
Nick Batum and
Rudy Gay. Yeah.
Both of those guys. I don't think Trevor Ariza is, I think that he is, Paul Millsap sort of on the verge of being washed. The rim cycle is pretty close there in the dishwasher, washing machine, or whatever the other washing equipment that you've got there at home. Whereas I think that there is a season or two at the very least, especially with Rudy Gay. I think that Rudy Gay is going to age relatively gracefully in this league. And Batum has shown us a level of revitalization that sort of goes in a small role. He can continue to produce because in the postseason, he wasn't getting 30 plus minutes a night. There was occasions where he was, but even in the 20 minutes that he was out there, that's the best version of the Clippers in a lot of respects, the best lineup that they did have. So I think that both of those guys provide a level of versatility and interchangeability. Whereas you'll be relying a lot more heavily on Jeff Green. But at the same time, we essentially did get that. And if Trevor Ariza is just your sort of Jeff Green insurance, then I think that Jeff Green is probably the best player out of these four. We've seen that. He also has great chemistry with the current roster, Kevin Durant, the rest of the guys, the leadership that he showed in this locker room this season. I think you lose a lot of that, those intangibles, if you were to go a different direction. Whereas I think Batum is a bit of a background dude. Rudy Gay seems to be not necessarily a vocal leader, but more of a sort of a fit in place sort of guy. So I think that that's something that you lose if you do lose a Jeff Green, which I think, when you're looking at these vet minimum sort of dudes and guys that fill out the roster, I think that is pretty important.
Yeah, especially I think, the Nets have a better idea about their locker room than we do. How important is Jeff Green? He could be crucial and it could be like mandatory that they re-sign him. Or it could be like, maybe there's another guy on the market, or maybe bringing back, a guy we discussed like a Garrett Temple on a vet minimum to help, fill in some of that locker room spot, but not as much on the court stuff.
Yeah, I think that, we've mentioned this plenty of times. After that Detroit Pistons loss, the big voice in terms of, getting the defense locked in was Jeff Green, post-game in the locker room and such. So I think we've seen how important Jeff Green was to this team, in terms of forming their identity on both ends of the floor. And to lose him, I think, would be a pretty massive loss. But there are at least a few names out there. That's why that part of me is like, you almost need maybe two decent enough guys to replace Jeff Green, because it's not just the on-court product, it's the off-court stuff, it's the chemistry, it's the ability to communicate, and all those little things that I think that Jeff Green gives you that probably when you sort of just find a fill-in guy and just a vet minimum dude, you don't really get those sort of character guys to the level of Jeff Green. Those guys aren't necessarily a dime a dozen. Yeah, Jarrett Temple is that, and we did discuss him, so maybe you do need to replace that, or maybe those things aren't necessarily a priority for Sean Marks, Steve Nash, and the rest of the Nets organization.
Yeah, and obviously I think you look at the relationship too with Kevin Durant and James Harden. How much does that play a role? Obviously the Nets have tried to make Kevin Durant as happy as possible and done things that, he's liked. So that could kind of lean towards Jeff Green being back, where then, maybe all you do have is the veteran minimum, or maybe somehow you convince Jeff Green to get the veteran minimum. But I think there was a comment from him saying he was looking to make a little bit more money this time than just the veteran minimum. So that's where it's just going to kind of be a situation. Who do you think is going to have the biggest impact in improving this team? And the other factors, like you said, with chemistry. But Jack, any other names you're looking at? I got a few more.
I've got some names, but before I do get to that one, Nick, the thing that I'm like about Jeff Green in terms of getting the money, he's made over $70 million in his career. So, he's obviously hasn't had that big contract, a four-year $80 million or something like that. Or maybe he has, but I can't necessarily remember. He's had, some contracts here or there, and he's been around the league long enough. I just think that it's going to be up to him what his priority list is going to be. Does he decide to go to like an Atlanta and get, a higher level exception money or whatever? Because I make this comparison a lot of the time, and not all people are Spencer Dinwiddie, but Spencer Dinwiddie's pretty smart when it comes to sort of talking about, the economics of the NBA. The difference between like, $1 and $10 million isn't a heap, but it's the difference between like 10 and 20 and 20 and 30. That's where the money starts to add up. So I don't think that Jeff Green's going to be getting what do you think is the max money that he would get on the open market, Nick? Is a team going to give him a mid-level exception? Because I can't necessarily see anything in the eight figures. I think $8-9 million on a 1 or 2 year deal is the maximum amount he would get on the market.
Yeah, I think 7 or 8 on that 1 year deal would probably be the max. But, you know, obviously crazier things would happen, or maybe there might not be a market for him just because he's older and some people are unsure of how he fits. Obviously, there's some of his game kind of comes to life a little bit more with James Harden, you know, of running that small ball five, and not every team can do that. Every team doesn't have the luxury of having a Kevin Durant and these different players the Nets have. So one thing I wouldn't rule out from the Nets is, like, they sign him back. I think they might have his early bird rights, or he's a veteran, so they can give him like some type of raise on his contract.
So 120% or something like that.
Yeah, 120%, and they could do that over the course of 3 years, and I think they could add a raise every single year, so maybe they could convince him to stay by giving him the longer contract with the money, and then obviously you're just kind of sucking it up later on, because it's not like everyone ages.
Yeah, I mean, we look at the teams that are out there, and I guess sort of just thinking about, you know, the Lakers, would they love to have him? Yes, but I don't necessarily see Jeff Green going that down the path. The team that I could see him going to is maybe like a Golden State. You know, I think that, you know, they've got a lot of things, a lot of moving parts, and I think that, you know, he's probably got prior relationships with some of the guys there as well. I don't necessarily know that, but, you know, I'm sure that he would fit in pretty nicely there. And, you know, the similar sort of vibe and situation to what Brooklyn is cultivating right now. But yeah, I think that Jeff Green still needs to be priority number one. And if the Nets were to retain him and the rest of the offseason, you know, the Nets lose Jeff Brown and Spencer, Bruce Brown, Spencer Dinwiddie, and a heap of, and, you know, other guys that are in the front rotation, you can sort of tip your hat to go, good, we got the guy that we know can produce for us in the postseason.
Jack, unprompted question, somewhat related to the topic. If you had the option to sign Jeff Green and Bruce Brown or re-sign Spencer Dinwiddie, which one are you doing?
Spencer Dinwiddie's a better player. And that's a really tough one, because you get, I guess, two bites at the apple when you got Jeff Green and Bruce Brown. Bruce Brown can get played off the... Bruce Brown's the maybe the... Not the worst player, because I think Bruce Brown has a higher, like, upside, you know, on his day than Jeff Green. But Jeff Green's serviceability and ability to be like, go, all right, we need you here. Get us a three. Play a bit of defense for us. Go on in the starting lineup when some of these guys are injured. I think that situation matters more for Bruce Brown than it does for Jeff Green.
Agreed. Because, like, we've literally seen Jeff Green defend freaking Bradley Beal and then see him defend Giannis. Like,
yeah. And look, Bruce Brown has guarded Chris Middleton and had some, you know, possessions here and there on Giannis as well. So it's not to say that he doesn't show defensive versatility, but I think it's the offense where it's just like, get us a three ball, hit a mid-range jumper for us, hit something in the post, where Bruce Brown just, he needs to have some space. He needs, you know, the floater. He needs to have, you know, a guy in the pick and roll and in the short roll or whatever. I think that... I honestly don't know, Nick. I would need some time to sort of think through it, and it's a cop-out answer to say that. I think Spencer Dinwiddie is the best player, and maybe you just go back to our own conversation and just go, you just want the best, most talented player on the roster, and you figure out the rest of it later. That's Spencer Dinwiddie, and I think it's not to say that, you know, if you lose Bruce Brown, you know, and you've still got Spencer Dinwiddie, I don't think that's a big loss. But we don't know necessarily because we didn't see it, but I think we could pretty confidently, sort of say that, you know, Spencer Dinwiddie could quite easily be a fifth man, fourth man out there in the rotation, and, you know, a guy that can get a bucket, a guy can attack off the closeouts and such. I guess I'll go Spencer Dinwiddie just because he is the best player, and ultimately you want the best player on your roster.
Yeah, and I think it also gives you more flexibility in terms of moving. You know what I mean? If you needed to move Spencer for another forward or some other role to get a better player, you could do that. Where I think with Jeff Green and Bruce Brown, like you said, I think you're taking somewhat of a chance with Jeff Green with his age and seeing maybe last year was somewhat of an outlier and he's going to have a lesser role. How is he going to play in that role? You know, I think you could take that in consideration. And Bruce Brown, like you said, is limited at different things and can kind of hamper the offense to an extent and make life harder for your superstars. And that's not exactly what you want. And Spencer could essentially do pretty much everything Bruce Brown can do, except the rebounding and probably defending up as much. I think Spencer can defend up a little bit in the right situation, but he's not going to have the same strength as Bruce Brown.
Yeah, I think the point you made about the sort of contract, if you want to offload them in some sort of fashion, you put Joe and Spencer together, you get a pretty tasty sort of deal in
return.
Yeah,
you might even get an all-star or like, fringe.
Damian Lillard, who knows? Let's just throw all the guards out there, all the three best guards in the NBA other than Steph Curry. But yeah, I think that's a fair point to make as well. Obviously, we see Joe Tsai spending his money left, right, and center on property and everything else. So he'd better pay goddamn Spencer Dinwiddie. Let's put it that way.
Yeah, I mean, I think it seems maybe a little bit more likely at this point, but who really knows? Jack, getting kind of back to some of the forwards, who else you got on your list?
On my list, Nick, a guy who I think is probably the least likely, but maybe one of the better players on this list is Shamichael Green. I think we did see that he was opt out of his player option of $7 million or something.
It was like 7.6. So that like makes me think like, I don't think the Nets have the money unless they offer the taxpayer mid-level exception.
Yeah, exactly. And I think maybe it could also be because I don't think he was utilized to the best extent in Denver, despite the fact that I really like his fit. And I would love his fit on a Brooklyn Nets team. You know, he is... You know, he would play small ball five better than Jeff Green does. And Jeff Green played it pretty well. And I think that lessens the defensive load on a Kevin Durant as well. Allows him to sort of just, do his thing offensively and not necessarily have the burden on the defensive end. Jamichael Green would be 1A on this list, but also he's probably the least likely, given what other teams are probably likely to give him in some form of contract.
Yeah, and I think also with him, like, there's some question about the defense at times and some of that, like, not, like, being there fully in the game. Like you said, maybe some of that's Denver, but it feels like at times when he's on the court, you kind of forget he's out there type of thing. He's closer to a true big than Jeff Green is, so I think you lose some of that, like, defensive versatility. He can switch a touch, but not to the same high level that, I don't want to say Jeff Green can do it at an extremely high level, but he can do it at a pretty good level from 2 to 4, so, and even 5 sometimes. So I think Jermichael Green, like you said, will probably be out of the Nets price range, which could end up being for the better, because he's a player that I wouldn't want to overpay. He'd be a guy that I'd want to get in the cheap, because I'm just not like super convinced that he's just like a consistent guy that you can have on a championship team, if that makes sense. Not to say that he's not a good player, but he's just not somebody I'd personally want to depend on.
Yeah, I mean, probably in terms of dependability, Batum is probably a guy that you would sort of go, you know what? We could probably rather give a $3 or $4 million less to a Batum and actually know that, he's shown he can give us something in the postseason. But I do also think that in 2020, he was underutilized by also, Doc Rivers. I thought that, the best version of the Clippers, that version of the Clippers, featured Jermichael Green at the 5 and, Marcus Morris at the 4 and the rest, and PG and Kawhi at the 2 and the 3. So I think that the situation does matter, and the Brooklyn Nets seem to find a way to get the most out of role players. Exhibit A and B, Bruce Brown and Jeff Green, who would have thought that we'd see, the seasons that we did from them. So that's why... whatever role player is acquired from a Brooklyn from a wing perspective, you can probably at least expect a level of bounce back or a level of reliability. Given that, I think just the coaching and the communication and everything, the way that the Nets sort of just hone in the roles of their players is top notch.
Yeah, I think just like the extra playmaking, you know what I mean? Like everything is kind of set on a platter for you when you play with the Nets because of James Harden, Kyrie Irving, and even Kevin Durant. Those guys are going to kind of set you up at different points. What else you got, Jack?
I've got former Brooklyn Nets great, David Nwaba. How good would David Nwaba... Can you imagine David... I think Justin brought this up on one of our previous pods. David Nwaba and Bruce Brown out there together... Dear Lord, Nets Twitter would explode and erupt like Mount Vesuvius and Fuji and Kosciuszko and whatever mountain it was in Pompeii that caused the goddamn apocalypse. I just think that it would be incredible, because I also do think that he played pretty goddamn well in Houston. Not goddamn well, but pretty well in Houston as well. And, I think we all have pretty fond memories of David Nwaba and just the level of energy, him just hitting the three balls and splashing them. The Nets could do worse than bringing back a former great.
Yeah, I mean, I think also he's only 28. He bounced back from that Achilles injury nicely. And I think he was playing better basketball when the Rockets were actually trying to win games as well. I think that always plays a role. Three-point shooting has fluctuated, shot well for the Nets, didn't shoot well for Houston last year. I think like David Nwaba makes sense, I guess, if you're looking at veteran minimums and guys to fill out the end of your bench. But his skill set does feel a little bit redundant with Bruce Brown being there. Like if the Nets lost Bruce Brown, I'd feel better about getting David Nwaba just because the idea of having two non-3-point shooters on the floor makes me a little sick at times just because, you know, the 3-point shooting is so bad. The spacing is off and it's two guys you can really help of. But he is a guy that just kind of does that complementary stuff. So I wouldn't want him and Bruce Brown both in the rotation, but if he was Bruce Brown insurance, that would make sense to me.
Yeah, I mean, the guys that are available, there aren't a huge amount of, you know, great three-point shooters. Yeah, great players, all three-point shooters in that regard. You know, Batum is okay. Millsap is okay. You know, Batum's good. Millsap is okay. Rudy Gay is okay. You know,
I would say Rudy Gay is probably good. He shot 38% of like four attempts, shot like 40 the year before. So I like Rudy Gay's 3-point shooting a little bit more. I think he's improving in that area.
Yep, Rudy Gay is good. I think Ariza is closer to David Nwaba than he is to Rudy Gay. So I think that like if you're picking those sort of dudes and you've got Trevor Ariza and you've got David Nwaba up against the wall and he can give either of them a vet minimum, give me David Nwaba, Nick.
Yeah, I mean, I think you can make that argument. I think Nwaba's a better defender at this point in time, and he provides some of those like intangible things like you kind of mentioned with Torrey Craig. You know what I mean? Just kind of and gives you some of that physicality that you miss sometimes with some of your superstars. So another name that we've talked about, I feel like a million times on this podcast with the Nets acquiring him. There's obviously some bad blood between him and Jacques Vaughn from Orlando days, but I think that could kind of get put to the side for a championship, and that'd be Mo Harkless.
Yeah, I think that's the Mo Harkless experience in Miami. Look, he was usurped in the rotation by Trevor Ariza. That tells you everything you need to know. So would you rather have Harkless or would you rather have, you know, Ariza? Look, I think that those two are a dime a dozen. They're essentially the same prototype of player. I think Ariza, you know, given the veteran experience and stuff, you know, the level of, you know, leadership you probably get from him, you might even prefer to go with Ariza. But Harkless, you know, his three ball is streaky at best. His defense is probably still his calling card. I think that if we were doing this in 2020, and we were doing this in 2020, you know, Mo Harkless was much higher on this list, but he certainly dropped down a few rungs on the ladder.
Yeah, I agree. I think obviously the fact that he couldn't have an impact in a team like Miami that gets the most out of a lot of players, and then they traded him, I think, to Sacramento, it's just like, okay, you know, like maybe he's not the right guy. But again, veteran minimum at the end of the bench or somebody just kind of take a flyer on. I think he does have good size and defensively, and he's okay being a role player, I think.
Yeah, and I think, you know, just for the amount of puns I would be able to do, you know, how could you be Mo Harkless? And the amount of content that I would get for jokes. Maybe I need to be higher on the Mo Harkless experience.
Yeah, maybe that's a real thing right there, Jack, especially you on Twitter. What else are you thinking?
I've got a couple of names here, Nick, and I'll throw one at you. Andre Iguodala. Now, the reason why I put it out there, you know, you sort of talked about two threes a little bit earlier. I think that's what Iguodala is, even though, you know, you can probably pinch it at a four as well. You know, I mean, he's gotten his money. You know, Miami's given it to him. Golden State has given it to him. And he also has, you know, a really, really, really good relationship with Kevin Durant. And I think that you look at also, you know, leadership and sort of the intangibles we talked about with Jeff Green. Iguodala may even have that to a greater extent. Now, I think that the one thing that he has less is basketball abilities. I don't necessarily know what he's going to provide on the court at this point in time, but as a locker room sort of dude, I think that that's where you sort of look at what, you know, Jamal Crawford, and I think Jamal Crawford's got a little bit more basketball skills in him. We sort of saw that before the 5-minute hamstring injury, which really, really sucked. But, you know, Andre Iguodala, I think, could be a guy and maybe in sort of like a Nicholas Batum honed in sort of role. All we need for you is like, you know, 10 minutes of defense on Trae Young or whoever else it might be. And I think that, you know, just his ability to create a nice cohesive locker room, vet minimum, why not?
Yeah, I think that's right, Jack. I think if Jeff Green were to leave, this would be a guy you maybe look at a little bit more for that veteran presence in the locker room. like you said, I think Miami depended on him a little bit too much. You know, in a smaller role, be it 10 minutes or just like spot games, I think he'd be a little bit more effective. And also gives you a little bit of, you know, ball handling. Like if, you know, we got into a situation that happened last year, not to say you want him running your offense, but he's a guy that at least can dribble the ball, pass a little bit, make a couple plays. The real issue with Iguodala, like you said, is the age. You know, he's definitely not moving the same. He's about to be, I think, 38 this upcoming season. And then the three-point shooting is just like one of the weirdest things, because you'll watch a game, Andre Iguodala hit like every three, and then he won't hit a three for like the next five games. So it's just like his offense is not much of anything at this point, which, you know, you can get away with on the net sometimes, but it's not something you want to consistently do. So like you said, veteran minimum, end of the bench, can fill a couple different roles. I wouldn't hate it.
Yeah, I think his best offensive skill, funnily enough, is probably his passing. You know, yep. He's a good ball mover. And, you know, as a guy, you know, if James, as a secondary sort of ball handler next to James Harden in sort of second units, I think would be decent enough, you know, in a similar sort of way. I think it's probably the only thing he does better than Jeff Green, you know, is his ball moving, and he's a creative passer.
Yeah, he's a very smart player.
Yeah, like one of the highest IQ basketball intelligence guys we've seen in the modern game. So, look, we're not getting Finals MVP Andre Iguodala, but, you know, I think you're still getting a serviceable enough dude to add to whatever number in the rotation you want to put him in.
Yeah, I agree, Jack. What else are you looking at?
So, Nick, probably now is where I get to, like, we've talked about tier one, tier two sort of dudes. Now it's probably like a sort of tier three. Now, I think the name that everyone every person, man, dog, and woman wants us to discuss is Carmelo Anthony, Nick. Carmelo Anthony is a Brooklyn net, a Brooklyn legend.
Thought I was going to get out of this today.
the Barclays Center legend, Barclays Center meme legend, because we know what happened in that Dwayne Wade final game where he was about to take that shot and then he didn't. One of the iconic memes in the 21st century. Carmelo Anthony is a Brooklyn net, Nick. Are you in on it as much as probably 80% of Nets Twitter is?
I am not. I mean, I think there's some way you can convince yourself, like, he does still have a little bit of scoring pop. He's a solid rebounder, but defensively, he's obviously not great. He's even worse at his age now, and it's just like, I'm not sure what he provides to the Nets other than like an emergency break option if people were to get injured and you need scoring pop. Like if he's in the rotation with the superstars, it doesn't make sense. But if a superstar goes down and you need to add, you know, 10 points, you know, Carmelo could probably get you that. And his three-point shooting has improved.
Yeah, he's always been a good three-point shooter, an incredible shot creator. Like I think that we could probably hear Kevin Durant go, "Hey, Sean, yeah, Melo. Straight buckets." And I think that they're that sort of, you know, we've sort of seen how Kevin Durant builds teams. I've said that time and time again. You know, he values offense. And look, is Melo ever going to give us a level of defensive competence? No, he is a bad, if not one of the worst defenders in the NBA. And that's where the Nets really do lack. And even like, you know, we're wondering about Blake Griffin's defense and such, but Blake Griffin is at least strong enough to be able to do stuff. And, you know, he knows the right matchups. Melo's a better rebounder.
He's more willingness, too, to, like, throw his body for, like, a charge. You know, like, Melo's not really going to do that. He has, not to say that he will never do that, but I just think it's more of a Blake Griffin trait.
Yeah, I don't know if I want Melo to stay Melo in Brooklyn or stay Melo in Portland. But look, as a guy in the rotation, Nick, I think that, you know, it might bring some new listeners to the Brooklyn buzz. And I need to think about it from the content perspective.
Brooklyn too.
He is from Brooklyn. So I don't, maybe me looking at it from a content perspective, like I was talking about with David Nwaba and Mo Harkless. I need to look at it that way rather than sort of like, you know, we're like Sean Marks or an assistant GM or whatever. And like, you know, we need to make this team. So it's like, Melo would give us some nights where like, you know, he gets like 20 points and we get like, you know, a solid amount of listens because people want to hear us talk about Carmelo Anthony. And, you know, maybe he becomes your new Mike James. I don't know.
No, I mean, I have a lot of respect for Melo. He's a great offensive player, obviously. I feel like he's a guy that probably got underappreciated during his, like, peak level because of the other great superstars in the league. So, like, I can't say I would completely hate it just because it's cool to have another former superstar on your team. And, like, shit, like, you put out a lineup of Kyrie, James Harden, Kevin Durant, Carmelo Anthony, and Blake Griffin. That'd be, like, super lit for, like, a 25-year-old Nick or 22-year-old Nick or whatever. So, like, yeah, it could definitely be cool. And I think there is some things to his game where he could add, and like I said, being an option if people were to get hurt. But it's like, I'm not sure he's the best fit. From a talent perspective, he's still probably one of the most talented free agents in terms of just like that offensive pop he can create.
Yeah, that lineup you mentioned would have like an offensive rating of like 135, but would have a defensive rating of like 150. Like, Kevin Durant's the only defender there. Like, yes, Kyrie Irving, we know what he can do. And yes, James Harden's an awesome post defender, and Melo is, you know, Melo.
Yeah, so it would be tough. So, like, I wouldn't rule it out, and I think there's some positives you could take of it, but he'd be a guy that you wouldn't be able to, like, consistently have in the rotation because there'd be issues, and I think he'd also probably have to get load managed at this point in his career.
Would he be a better fit in Brooklyn or in Portland? Could you see what do you think his priorities are right now? Is it, you know, he's now going to start ring chasing? You know, he's a free agent and such, and, you know, Portland, does he show a semblance of loyalty to them because of, you know, they gave him the opportunity, you know, Dame and CJ were all about it. And maybe Dame gets into the year of Neil O'Shea. It's just like, you know, keep Melo for me at the very least, you know, because all these other dudes suck. But, you know, Melo at least gives me a bucket every now and then. What do you think Melo's priorities are? Is it more championship, or do you think it's, you know, a level of stability that he's gotten in Portland the last couple of seasons?
I mean, honestly, he's 37. How many years does he really have left to ring chase? I think ring chasing is probably more important at this point. And I think he's done enough to kind of establish more respect as a role player where he could intrigue contending teams. Like, I think it makes more sense for Carmelo to go to the Lakers, like, just because of his relationship with LeBron and that ring chasing opportunity than it does to go to the Nets. I wouldn't rule it out, but it just seems like it makes more sense. And obviously, we know what the bad blood between D'Antoni and Anthony too.
Yeah, true. So I think that there's a lot of differing sort of factors. You know, does he want to live in New York and Brooklyn? Would he want to live in L.A. and Lala? No, L.A., not Lala. Sorry.
That's no more.
In saying that, you know, I'm sure that we'll have to do some form of a 45-minute show if Carmelo Anthony were to sign with the Brooklyn Nets. I'll have to dive deep into some film, which is always a fun experience, and try and find, you know, about one steal he's had the past.
Well,
you know,
there was a game. I can't remember if this was last year in the bubble or the postseason this year. Or these last two seasons, it felt like one. I think he had like three blocks in like the matter of like 6 minutes or something. I was like watching a game and I was like, what? Melo's playing defense right now? Like, he was really locked in. I think that's the problem too with him sometimes, is like, I think defensively he could be better, but he doesn't put enough effort on the end of the floor. And, you know, that's what talented offensive players do sometimes.
Yeah, maybe you get a Blake Griffin level of competence and re-engagement. You know, there is a world out there where that could happen, and I would not be totally shocked. But yeah, I just sort of think back to like when me, you, and Corey were on like Spotify Green Room, and we were doing like a sort of live listening party, watch party, and with I think it was Portland Lakers or some game last year, and like Melo was just like straight money and buckets, in I think the third quarter or something. And look, that's always fun. And I think that, you know, as much as like, you know, the Nets were to get Carmelo Anthony, and, you know, if Batum was still on the market and these other guys are still on the market, if, you know, he is the, as I sort of alluded to, and that's this sort of next, this final tier for me, if we were to get him, I'd be enthused about it. I think we'd have a lot of fun with Carmelo Anthony, but he's not getting number seven, that's for sure.
Yeah, no, that's 100% sure. Let's see, Jack, anybody else that you were considering?
I had the Johnsons, not necessarily the Johnson brothers, but James and Stanley. Now, both of these guys, again, you know, what do you get from them? I think that James Johnson would almost be just like what we saw with Wilson Chandler as a Brooklyn Net, to be honest.
Yeah, and I mean, I think he's also more physical. Like, his physicality level is a lot higher. He's also, like, somebody who's definitely willing to fight. He's, like, MMA pro. I think, like, everybody in the NBA is scared of him. And I think he could play a little bit of small ball five, too. Like, he's done that a little bit at different points. And maybe there's a chance he kind of pops off. Like, he was pretty good in Miami, and then his shot just completely fell off a cliff. So maybe they can kind of get back to some of that. I wouldn't hate it. Like, he would be a guy that I would add that I wouldn't want in the rotation, but a veteran minimum that could give you spot minutes at four or even at five if needed, and just really gives you just like somebody who gives that, to a lesser extent, that like PJ Tucker level of physicality.
Yeah, I mean, we need to complete like the Johnson trio, Alizé, Tyler, James. And maybe like if you get Stanley Johnson as well, like you get like the Infinity Gauntlet or some shit. I don't know, some Marvel DC reference you want to make there. But you know, it's, Johnson's a cool last name.
I like James more than I like Stanley. I think Stanley just doesn't really do enough. I think defensively he was supposed to be better. He's never really been that guy. And offensively, he's bad. And like he's never shown at any point to be good. Where I feel like James Johnson, not to say he's been good offensively, but he's been competent enough. Yeah, that was years ago, but still, like in the right role. Like he seems like the guy that would be on a championship team that could just like turn up his effort level times 20 and just be like insane in terms of just getting like those hustle plays.
Yeah, and that's probably why, you know, Rondae Hollis-Jefferson is also on my list, because I think that, I don't know maybe why I've always been a big fan of RHJ. I think I did a piece on him in like 2017 for like OGD Basketball. Yep. It's maybe why I've always been high on him. And, you know, my co-host has a hyphen as well, so maybe I've got a soft spot for hyphens in my life. But, yeah, I just... And maybe it's also, you know, I remember what he did against Portland and against Damian Lillard and, you know, his level of defense. I just think that Rondae Hollis-Jefferson is an NBA player, and I'm almost surprised about, you know, his, you know, absence and, you know, what we saw from him in like Minnesota in the preseason and such. I'm like, damn, like this dude is like the best defensive player for Minnesota. And then he's just off the roster. And I'm just like, yeah. But he's like, I still think he has stuff to give. And like, unlike Stanley Johnson and, he has familiarity with the Brooklyn Nets system as well. I think he can play some small ball five. Obviously, especially if he's next to Jeff Green or Kevin Durant, I think that. And then you're talking about, you know, Bruce Brown. You know, Rondae Hollis-Jefferson, I think, is probably diversified himself enough to probably get to that level. I think he'd be awesome in the open court with James Harden. Like, obviously, he's a little bit erratic and such, but that dude is just a ball of energy. And, you know, I'm a big fan of RHJ.
Yeah, I mean, Rondae Hollis-Jefferson, loved him when he was on the Nets. I think the thing with him that's like kind of surprised me to an extent with just his career trajectory is that he's never really found a way to like calm down and be under control. If he could just find like, not to say even composure, just like everything he does, like just seems so like sporadic, like full 100% all the time, that if he could just like slow his game down a touch, I feel like he could improve drastically. And I think also just sometimes he almost seems like a little frazzled, like defensively, like he'll be overly aggressive and put himself in bad position. I think there are skills to his game. I wouldn't hate it, but he probably wouldn't be my first choice just because like, I really just don't know what I'm getting with Rondae. Like as much as I love him and what he was with the Nets, it's just like he's so sporadic. Like he could come in the game and be that elite defender that you mentioned, or he could also give away two fouls in 40 seconds.
I almost think he would be better as a Brooklyn Net now than, okay, maybe it's...
I think every Net would be better now because they're playing with three superstars. And I think even just like quick thought to the head is James Harden pick and roll with Rondae. Like he can finish layups to an extent when he's on. Sometimes he's not.
Yeah, and I think that his ability, I think he's always been a better role player. Like his skill set just screams, you know, high level role player, and that's what the Nets need right now. And you know, in seasons past, they've needed Rondae Hollis-Jefferson to be one of their second or third best players, in certain regards. So look, he obviously was just before the Sean Marks tenure, which is maybe why he's not back as a Brooklyn Net, but. And, you know, he doesn't necessarily, I saw one of my favorite videos from an NBA player is him, like, not necessarily believing in dinosaurs or how, like, the dinosaur fossils were found and stuff. You know, out, you know, Rondae Hollis-Jefferson wilding out about the existence of dinosaurs. A lot of fun, if anything. And, again, more content, Nick. I'm trying to think content-wise. Rondae Hollis-Jefferson, bit of nostalgia element. We listened back to, you know, episode 8 rather than episode 450 of the Brooklyn Buzz, and you know, my voice is a little bit higher. Well, honestly, it's not, but it's the you know, where we got for that long, but you know, just yeah, get a bit nostalgic, and you know, maybe we could do some revisited episodes, and you know, get post some cool clips of us, you know, reliving the good old days. They're not the good old days. They're good days right now, to be honest.
Yeah, the good old days are really about to come this upcoming season. But, yeah, I wouldn't rule it out. Like, he's a guy, I think, at the end of the bench, you could do worse than him. So it's not like he's my first choice. But I think there's just some questions about him. And I'm not sure his Nets tenure ended, like, crispy. I don't have anything to report, but I just have just a little bit of a vibe on that. Another guy at the end of the bench would be like Solomon Hill. Don't really love him. Doesn't really do much offensively. He's just kind of
LeBron stopper.
Yeah, I mean, he can play. I mean, literally stopped his ankle, but that was a little bit too much. This is a weird name that I really didn't think about going in, but I just popped up in my head, is Zach Collins on like a veteran minimum deal. Another guy, though, that can't stay healthy, but when he is healthy, very talented and could fill in that 4 and 5 type of spot. Kind of more so probably in the center talk rather than the 4 talk, but just kind of hit the head real quick.
Yeah, I think he the upside is sort of like, you know, what we're talking about with some of these younger dudes on this list, Torrey Craig and Otto Porter Jr. and such. You know, the upside is immense for Zach Collins, but I think that the amount of opportunities he would get to showcase his skill set would be limited in a situation like Brooklyn. But, you know, if the Nets could somehow snag him, that'd be a big get.
Yeah, I wouldn't be surprised. Like, he feels like he almost needs an entire season to just, like, get his body right. Because it's just, like, been back-to-back-to-back injuries. I've really liked his game when he was actually playing, but it's just been rare to see that lately. Any other names you got, Jack?
I've got three. One name that Corey Waldron of The Outlet and Full Access Spaces probably can't say. Nemanja Bjelica. And I don't think actually Bill Simmons can say his name either. I always hear him like call him Bijalika or something. But yeah, obviously he was in Miami and his 3-point shooting went off a cliff for some reason.
Yeah.
But that's his prime skill. His prime skill is small ball 5, 3-point shooting. You know, I'm sure Mark Stoll has had a little bit of a thing for, you know, international European dudes. They haven't necessarily worked out to the greatest extent, a la Janan Musa and Rodion Skurutz. But maybe Nemanja
Bjelica. Right there. That's going to get us some extra listeners.
There we go. Come on. Russia. I don't know what country. Latvia? Is Rodion's Latvian?
Yep. Because of the Porzingis tie.
And is Musa Russian or Serbian?
No. Damn, he's from like a really small country, but I think he reps like, maybe he's from the same spot Mirza Teletovic is from. Bonzia? Gotta look it up, Jack.
Or else all of our listeners from whichever country I'm trying to think of are going to desert us. And, you know, we love all the listeners of the Bosnia. Okay.
I was kind of close. Wasn't sure exactly what it was, but there we go. I think Mirza Teletovic is from there as well.
A lot of from that sort of range of, you know, Latvia, Serbia, we know how great Nikola Jokic is. There's some really quality basketball talent there. And maybe the Nets, maybe we haven't discussed enough about Janan Musa and Rodion Skurutz on this list, Nick. But no, I think that that's a discussion for another day and maybe, you know, a Patreon that no one will subscribe to. But a name that I did, obviously, we know about. Do you have any thoughts, I guess, on Bjelica before I move on to two of my final names?
Not really. I mean, like you kind of said, Jack does have the 3-point shot when it's on. Defensively, not very good. Like, honestly, the memory that I have in my head for Bjelica is the Nets cooking the Kings to come back in that comeback victory and D'Angelo Russell scoring on him at the rim multiple times. So that's just like, okay, no disrespect to D'Lo, but not a great finisher inside against contact. And if Bjelica can't stop him, then who is he really stopping? Obviously, that was years ago, but...
He's gotten better defensively, Nick. You know, he's learned a lot from Eric Spoelstra, Pat Riley. We'd be getting a defensive stopper in Brooklyn. No, there's no chance of that. But you know, the final two names I had, Nick, were Michael Kidd-Gilchrist and Mike Scott.
Okay, I got one more. Semi Ojeleye.
Yeah, I mean, again, we're in tier 3.
We're in flyer territory here.
Yeah, these are guys that are number 12 in the rotation. So I guess rank those three for me, Nick.
So Semi Ojeleye, Mike Scott, and Michael Kidd-Gilchrist, they all aren't very good. They all shouldn't be in your playoff rotation. Mike Scott has hit a big three against the Nets in the postseason. That one was very painful.
But there was also texting on the...
That was Amir Johnson. But I'm trying to think of like what each can bring. Michael Kidd-Gilchrist, like, no, I just couldn't stand watching that shot on a regular basis. So he's automatically going to the bottom for just my viewing pleasure. Mike Scott is probably the most competent in terms of like both ends of the floor. Semi Ojeleye, I think defensively can do some things, but has a fouling problem and offensively hasn't really developed much. I think I would probably take Semi just because I want someone to throw at Giannis and that's like actually stronger than him. And I think Semi Ojeleye is like one of the few forwards in the NBA that probably could fit that or at least match up to him to an extent. Like, he's not going to stop him, but he just gives you some of that bulkiness. So there's like, I don't want to say it's an elite skill, but it's a good skill he has, where the other guys, they, you know, Michael Kidd-Gilchrist has bounced around, and Mike Scott hasn't even really, didn't even really play last year.
Yeah, Semi is like thick. Like that dude is like thick with the capital T-H-I double C.
He's like thick for NFL player, for like, he's just built. Like he's just a big dude.
Yeah, and I think, you know, if you have Semi Ojeleye and Bruce Brown out there, thickness levels and swollenness levels are on a next level. Look, I think Semi has something, whereas I don't think any either of these other guys. I think Michael Kidd-Gilchrist, the version of defense, and we sort of talked about, you know, 3D, 3 or D. You know, he's just D, and I don't even know how high that level of D is these days. I need to stop saying D, but I'll just say defense. But in saying that, for content purposes as well, Nick, Semi Ojeleye, Celtics Lab crossover, I think we'd be able to get some decent content there as well.
Yeah, I think the one thing that you say about Semi that like would concern you is Boston was terrible last year. They had a ton of injuries in their depth, and he couldn't even get on the floor. You know what I mean? Like, I think he was partial. Like, he was one of the guys that might have had COVID as well, but still, I think the one thing that makes you feel okay, like, could Semi Ojeleye develop into a PJ Tucker? Like, that'd be something. Not to say like maybe to the fullest extent, but corner threes and defense. Like, could that be him? I think that's all he really shoots is corner threes. I'd have to look at his shot chart, but just watching him, that's what it feels like.
Yeah, maybe he could be a semi version of PJ Tucker. There we go. I'm all in on Semi Ojeleye. I could make a lot of semi jokes over 82 games.
So maybe that could be it. Anybody else that missed? Actually, Jack, I have one more name that actually is a good player. Reggie Bullock. That would be more of a taxpayer mid-level exception. That's why I didn't mention it before. But just if it got to it, or maybe he signed a veteran minimum, I think he's a solid two-way a role player.
Nah, big 15. He ain't going to fit on the roster. Nah. I had him on my list as well, but I sort of, in a similar way with Jermichael Green, didn't necessarily see it happening because I think that his season with New York was really, really good.
Yeah.
And I think he is the... I think his three-point shooting was great. He's a pretty good defender as well. But it's very rare we see guys who sort of develop some sort of Knicks allegiance, you know, go to, you know, across the bridge to the better basketball team in the black and white.
Yeah, he might actually want to win championships instead of one playoff game, but that's just me.
I mean, the reliability of Julius Randle and Kevin Durant, I don't know who you're taking, Nick. Who knows? Did Julius Randle make the All-NBA team, by the way?
He did. I think he actually made second team, which was kind of crazy. But
yeah, Kevin Durant didn't. Interesting. Yeah. Let's put it that way.
I can't think of it. There's a couple more names that we possibly could talk about, but they're really just flyers at this point. Like Isaac Bonga is a guy that I've always loved for some reason. You know, there's just a couple more names, but I don't think they're really relevant. But Jack, anything else you want to discuss on this topic?
Look, Nick, there's we're scraping the bottom of the barrel. Trey Lyles. I'm literally just scrolling through the names.
That was like a Nets sweetheart for a while, like for Nets Twitter. They really wanted Trey Lyles, but he just has not been good. No disrespect to him. He just feels like a guy that if he got in better NBA shape, he might be able to take another level in his game, but that's not my problem.
Yeah, true. Is Dante Hall, is that former Nets great Dante Hall?
Yeah.
I see on this list. Yeah. I mean, how is he not still a Brooklyn Net? Orlando, give us back our dude, the Giannis stopper. We're talking about Semi Ojeleye as a Giannis stopper, Nick. Dante Hall, throw him out there. Yes, please. Yeah.
He'd probably stop him another way. He might just punch him right in the face.
Absolutely. I could see Dante Hall in like a Thanasis Antetokounmpo sort of role. Throw him out there for like a minute and just be like an annoying.
Yeah.
Sort of dude. I mean, I'm given some time removed from that Bucks series, I've warmed to the Antetokounmpo family. But, you know, come the regular season, the heat is back on and we know how good Dante Hall is at stopping that Greek freak.
Yeah, I can't say I feel the same way. I feel like Giannis has been talking a little bit of subliminal shit with some of his comments, but we'll save that for another day. Jack, if you had to give me like your ranking of maybe your top three, excluding Jeff Green, what would it be?
I had to be Nicholas Batum, Nick. I think he's probably 1A almost by himself.
Yeah.
Otto Porter Jr., I think would be a rung below that, and just literally scrolling through my names here, and Rudy Gay, I guess.
Yeah.
You know, I think that it's almost like we were talking about like tiers before, and like, you know, we talked about, you know, Paul Millsap and all these sort of guys. I honestly think that Batum is maybe the best player available, also the best fit for the Brooklyn Nets, and the other guys have, are here or there. You know, it's not necessarily like, you know, okay, I know what I'm going to get from Rudy Gay. I know what I'm going to get from Otto Porter Jr. We've discussed all those guys at length. So I think that those are my top three. I'm not sure if you have a different list.
Yeah, I think I'd probably be the same, Jack. I might swap Rudy Gay and Otto Porter just because I have no idea if Otto Porter can play more than 25% of the season. If he did, you know, he might be a better option. But I'd argue, too, that Batum and Gay give you a little bit more versatility in terms of being able to play bigger, where I feel like Porter would have a better chance of almost playing down. And he played a little bit of two when he was with Washington at different points when he was first drafted because he's just very skinny.
Yeah, a lot of versatility. And I will say that it was very hard to leave Dont'a Hall out of my top three.
Yeah, it really was. Jack, all right, one more question. I know we're scraping right here. But Nets re-sign Jeff Green. Batum they can't re-sign because he's taxpayer mid-level and they're going to give taxpayer to Jeff Green, let's say. Who's the guy you want them to target to complement the Jeff Green skill set?
Oh, it's Carmelo Anthony. No, it's not Carmelo. I mean, I think a lot of people would want Carmelo Anthony. Look, you don't need a lot if you've got Jeff Green. So probably Trevor Ariza, I would say, Nick. I mean, Ariza or Craig. I think that Craig is almost like a more physically healthy version of Otto Porter Jr. in terms of like, you know, young guy. I think his defensive versatility is probably the best. Ariza is probably the most, you know, serviceable, reliable, and also has a decent relationship, obviously, with James Harden, Mike D'Antoni, and I think that that matters. I think that we've sort of seen that the Brooklyn Nets family and the connections that are made there. That's why I think, you know, Ariza might be not necessarily have a Jeff Green sort of season, but would be a better version of the Miami and maybe somewhere near what he showed a little bit in Portland before, you know, he had to leave before he had to leave that organization as well.
Yeah, I mean, I think there's some great choices. I mean, you could go with honestly a lot of different names because, like you said, Jeff Green would be the guy that you want to bring back. I would maybe feel more comfortable taking the risk on Otto Porter at that point because I know how durable Jeff Green's been majority of, you know, recently with the Nets last year. I could also just, I don't know, I have like some fixation with Rudy Gay for some reason that I just feel like he can do some things. And I just feel like he's the type of guy that's ready for that championship team to really like adapt his role. Because like you mentioned earlier with the Spurs, he was willing to adapt on just to make the playoffs. Like what would he be willing to do to win a championship? And I think honestly, you know, Otto Porter might be more talented, but you could argue that Rudy Gay might be the most talented guy that's not, you know, the star level or like true tier one free agent.
Agreed. I would say he'd be him and Batum are probably one and two on this list in terms of guys that, like, you know, can hit a bucket, can play a decent level of defense, can rebound the ball, can pass it a little bit.
Yep.
Like I always say, are basketballers. You know, we're not doing the basketballer hoopers conversation here on the Brooklyn Buzz. That's for Twitter and Twitter Spaces. But yeah, I think that I would be most happy if the Nets were to have two wings heading into next season, two backup wings, rather than like 3 million guards that are under 6'3".
Yeah, especially if some of these wings have versatility to their game where they can handle the ball a little bit, play make. You know, let's say they got three wings and the third one was Andre Iguodala, who wasn't really going to play. But then he gives you, you know, honestly could give you a little bit of backup point guard minutes in terms of like that third string thing if you really got caught in a pinch. But Jack, I guess I'll ask you again. Anything else?
I'm sort of just saying in relation to that and piggybacking off your thoughts, Nick, you know, if you give me Craig or Nwaba or Iguodala or PJ Tucker, even in a world where he comes to the Brooklyn Nets, I think that those guys are just better fits in Brooklyn right now than, you know, Tyler Johnson, Mike James, Chris Chioza, those sort of guys. And because right now the wing depth is Kevin Durant, Jeff Green, and Alize Johnson. That's what the wing, the genuine wings that are currently on the Brooklyn Nets roster. You know, Joe Harris obviously has played 2, 3, and 4 throughout the season and throughout his career. But as, you know, actual wing capable players and actually guys that are 6'8" and above, I think that the having a bit of depth there certainly couldn't hurt. And you know, it's Jeff Green insurance, it's Kevin Durant insurance, it's whatever insurance. Having wings is an important position in the modern NBA.
And given where your stars are and their skill sets, the wings make more sense because, you know, knock on wood, we don't want to see multiple stars go down. But in the situation where, you know, Kyrie Irving gets hurt and you still have James Harden and Kevin Durant, it's easier to swing in a wing right there. And then you also have guards that are competent. Like Joe Harris didn't play well in the postseason. We would hope he'd bounce back if he's on the Nets next year. But you also have Landry Shamet, who's would hopefully improve going to the season. More playoff experience. I think him putting on a little bit more size and developing his point guard skills too could be something. So, and just because of the teams you're going to match up with, and you don't want to tire Kevin Durant out with asking him to be your best defender and best offensive player. But Jack, I think we covered, you know, free agent target forwards pretty damn well. Appreciate everybody listening. Jack, always a pleasure. And check out The Buzz on all stream platforms.